I'm not naive to the fact that there are other media outlets. I am honored that you take time to fit the MTOM podcast. Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. And the Market to Market TV show into your weekly, or maybe you watch us on loop. That's awesome. Thanks, Mom. That I don't even know if she does that either. But we know that there are other news sources out there, one of them being Brownfield. And Ken Anderson, little note here, Ken retired at the end of 2020, so why not a perfect chance to dish on his old employer? Except he doesn't do that. He has a lot of great things to say about his time there and his time in ag journalism and also what he did between his two stints. We'll talk about those and how it put a little bit of perspective. He is a grandfather, a father, and a sports fan. We should have kept rolling for the discussion about sports afterwards, but I think it might get us both in trouble. We'll discuss some changes, how coverage has different social media, how it has altered what he's had to do, and find out what life was like in Clark, South Dakota, where he grew up. And there is a story about Domino's Pizza. I guess that's as much of a tease as I have. If you like what you hear in the MTOM podcast, we would consider it an honor if you subscribe. You can like, you can share, do whatever you want. I know that tapping is easy, liking is hard, and listening can be painful. But thank you for enduring this episode of the M2M podcast. All right, Ken, it's 9 a.m., a couple of days after you retired. That's really mean of me. I'm sorry. I first just got to say thank you. Are you an early riser?
You know, I'm up around 5:30. In network radio, we don't have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to be ready to go live at 5 o'clock or whatever. So I got to sleep in a little bit over the years, which was nice.
Unless you were having to do one of those crazy road trips and go on a story, and sometimes you'd have to maybe get up before 5:30.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I for Brownfield, I covered Nebraska and Iowa. And so I do a lot of meetings in Des Moines where I had to travel through Omaha. And my wife and I just drove through Omaha yesterday we were doing some shopping there. And I told her, I said, boy, I don't miss this early morning commute through Omaha. Cause I'd usually hit Omaha. I'm in Lincoln. I'd usually hit Omaha around 7 o'clock, and the traffic there was just crazy. So yeah, I don't miss that commute, from Lincoln to Des Moines.
Well, I'll get into how we've crossed paths here in the state of Iowa, but I want to do a little background on you, Ken. You're a South Dakota guy, grew up on a farm. What was the town, or what was the closest town?
Yeah, Clark, South Dakota, northeastern South Dakota. It's west of Watertown, and it was a small farm. We grew at one point, grew and raised about everything, corn, oats, wheat. We had pigs, sheep. We milked cows for a while. We had a cow herd, and you know, just a really diversified farming operation, as a lot of them were back in the '60s. But as I told you earlier, as I grew up, I had no desire to be a farmer. It just wasn't in my blood, and I was ready to try something else.
Who else was on the farm with you? Brothers, sisters?
I had one sister, 3 years younger than me. And so it was just my mom and dad and the two of us.
So did she get into the farming business then?
No, she did not either. No. In fact, when I was a sophomore in college, my folks decided to sell the farm. It was in 1975. And same year that I got married, in fact, after my sophomore year in college. And they decided to sell the farm and move into town. They bought a small motel and ran that for the rest of their career.
Well, that's quite the varied background. Did you ever think that, because you went to SDSU, is that right?
Right, South Dakota State, Jackrabbits, yes.
Did you have a thought that agriculture was going to be at all in your future, like journalism agriculture, or when you left the farm, you put it in the rearview mirror?
Yeah, I really did. I didn't have any thoughts of being involved in agriculture going forward. I majored in journalism with what we called the broadcast option. I worked at the college radio station and kind of cut my teeth there. and learned the business a little bit, and didn't have any intention of going into agriculture. Just to go into the connection just a little bit, the head of the radio and TV division at South Dakota State was a guy named Eric Brown. Well, Eric's dad, Eric was from Lexington, Nebraska originally, home of KRVN radio. Eric's dad, Max Brown, was a longtime general manager at KRVN. And as I was getting ready to graduate, Eric came up to me and said, you should send an application or a resume to my dad down in Nebraska. So I did, and I ended up working at KRVN a week after I graduated from college and was there for the next 12 years. Now, KRVN, for those that aren't familiar, is a giant agricultural radio station in central Nebraska, 50,000 watts. They boom out all over Nebraska and surrounding states. So it was an amazing opportunity to get started in this business as a farm broadcaster.
Well, if you get west of the Mississippi, I mean, I think there's three giants. There's the station in Yankton. There's the station you're referring to in WHO. I mean, those had long been, and then you get into Kansas City, and that's a different story. But what did it mean when those call letters, when you would call someone for an interview? I mean, did that instantly get you in the door sometime, build some credibility?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it really did, especially in Nebraska, you know, and some of the surrounding areas. Yeah, KRVN, I had many people over the years tell me, you know, you're like part of the family here. We wake up to you in the mornings, and, you know, you're just so important to our farming operation as well with the information and such that we were providing.
It was probably better that you called to get an interview than showing up in their driveway, because they would recognize the voice before they'd recognize the face. Is that that's kind of how the radio joke is, isn't it?
Yep, that's right. Yep, a face for radio. That's very true.
Well, no. That's not what I'm saying there. No. You got a good, handsome man there, Ken. But it's amazing. You'll hear people on the phone and go, wait a minute, I know that voice. Where is that from? And a voice has a soothing, calming effect on people. We talk about in this COVID coverage era, we put more emphasis on the audio than sometimes the video for certain stories or interviews or things like that, because we think it's more important to hear things. And for those that are listening to this podcast, they appreciate good audio. What made good audio for you as a reporter?
Okay.
And you can take that two different ways, because we both know that it means two different things. There's audio quality, which is kind of what I'm talking about. But what makes good audio quality for an interview in your mind?
Well, I always kind of prided myself on let me say this. When I first started doing an interview, was one of the toughest things for me to do, because I was always trying to formulate that next question in my head, and a lot of times I wasn't listening to what the person I was interviewing was saying to me. And so this person might say, and then the grain bin collapsed and it was a disaster. Well, if I wasn't listening closely, I may have come with the next question. So how was your crop this year? So interviewing, when you talk about quality and quality of interviews, I learned a lot over the years as to be able to listen with one ear and be formulating or thinking about my next question on the other side. I think that's what really made for good interviews. And the other thing is to spend a little time before you start an interview, getting people relaxed and comfortable with you. You know, spend 5 minutes talking about, you know, how things are going on the farm, how's the family, well, you know, tell me about the family, that type of thing. And getting people relaxed, you just don't launch right into it. It's kind of like we did this morning, spending a few minutes before we started here, getting to know each other a little bit.
Well, and I'm with you on every single one of those points, Ken. And I agree that making someone relaxed. I told my father this when I first started. He farmed in Buchanan County, Northeast Iowa. And one day we were talking, this is probably 5-10 years into my career. And he said, yeah, the Waterloo Courier reporter called the other day and wanted to talk to me. And I told him no. And I'm like, you're killing me. Why? He goes, oh, I just didn't think I had anything important to say. And I'm like, that's what I have to do every single day, is pick up the phone and basically beg someone to bring a very intrusive television camera, take a whole bunch of their time, come into their home or come into their home environment and ask them questions. I said, half, if not more than half of the job of setting up an interview sometimes is sales. You mm-hmm. have to convince yeah. someone that either it's their idea or it's a good idea for them to talk to you. Do you subscribe right. to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I always told people before we started, that we're just going to have a conversation. You know, it's not, I'm not Mike Wallace. This isn't 60 Minutes. You know, I just want to visit with you and ask a few questions. And if I ask something you don't want to, you know, you're not comfortable with, just tell me. And I feel like for the most part, I was able to get the most out of interviews by taking that approach.
But people have to understand, though, a little bit about the way things work. I don't necessarily know how Brownfield worked, but I do know that most newsrooms are set up the same way. An editor or a boss will say, Ken, I need you to go over to go to the Iowa Pork Congress or the National Pork Expo, and I'm going to have you cover this. The big story, you know, do a story on this, and you're going to drive the 3 hours, and you're going to get there and think, oh, that's what the story is. Well, you launch into your first question, or you're at your first press conference. That's not what the story is, and so then you got to go back and tell the boss. But there's a balance between what you think the story might be, trying to avoid any spin by a group that might be, or their viewpoint on a certain thing, and you listening to what the story is, right? I mean, that's how I see those three things. Do you see it that way too?
Yeah, you know, and reporters are accused sometimes of, mainly the mainstream media, of having an agenda, you know, and going in and this is what I think the story is, and I'm going to find the person to verify what I wanted to say, you know. And I will admit, I've gone into meetings thinking, okay, this is the story that I'm going to pursue. This is going to make a great story. And you find out that there's nothing there, that it's really not a story. So yeah, to your point, you've got to be flexible. And I've always joked in an interview, a lot of times the best question I ask is the last one, when I say, is there anything else that you'd like to share? And sometimes that's when the story develops. You know, I may be asking the wrong questions. And when I give that person the opportunity to say what they really want to say, that's when something comes out that leads to a good story. It's funny how that works.
It is. Can you identify a good interviewee when you see them standing from across the room?
Oh, not necessarily.
Good, because I can't either.
No, I'm surprised sometimes. You know, I mean, I'll see somebody and visit with them for a bit and think, boy, this is going to be a great interview. And when you turn on the recorder, they kind of freeze. And despite my efforts to get them relaxed. And on the other hand, sometimes somebody you think this is going to be a tough one, actually, once they get going, they're a great interview. So, no, it's you never know.
Did you prefer, I mean, being in radio, you could call people and get voice interviews via the phone, whatever right. technology. Did you prefer that, or did you prefer visiting with people, excuse me, one-on-one, face-to-face?
I really didn't have a preference. I enjoyed phone interviews. But yeah, being face to face with somebody and being able to read their face as they're answering questions, I mean, that's obviously the best way to do it. And I mean, sometimes you can tell just by the way they're answering your question, if there's a needs to be a follow-up there, you know, that they're not giving you the whole they're not telling you everything that you, that they want to tell you. So there's, face-to-face always best.
There's a mask of half of this face says, move on, and the other half says, ask me about it, right?
Right, right, exactly.
All right, so in covering, you're in journalism for a while and then step out. What pulled you back in?
Yeah, you know, I worked at KRVN for 12 years. Excuse me. And I decided to jump out of the nest, so to speak, and try something different. And I went to work for a regional seed company called NC Plus Hybrids and moved to Lincoln and did advertising and marketing work for NC Plus for 15 years. And it was a great experience. Learned a lot about the, you know, the agribusiness side of things and how that works. And then after that, I tried working in public relations with a couple of communications firms, marketing communications firms, and that just wasn't working for me. And the opportunity with Brownfield arose in 2008, and I jumped on it right away because radio was my first love, and boy, I couldn't believe it when I saw that there was an opportunity to be based in Lincoln and to work for Brownfield, the largest agricultural radio network in the country. So I jumped right on that. And I'll tell you what, the last 12 years of my career with Brownfield were just fantastic. Just can't say enough about how great the organization is and the great people that I got to work with.
Well, you set me up for a simple question. Why? I mean, you mentioned the people, but I mean, was covering the stories that you covered, was that rewarding and did it make time fly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the great thing about radio and what I loved in the first place was just every day there was a, as I like to say, a blank canvas, and you get out the paints and you go to work. You never knew what story you were going to go after that day or what the big story of the day was going to be. And that was the part about radio that I loved, that and then being able to bring that information to the listener, excuse me, and the reader. Because now, of course, the website and what we do there is just as big as what we're putting out on the air. But yeah, that was always the exciting part of it for me.
When you mention 08, so what year did you leave KRVN?
In 1989.
Okay, so from 89 to 2008, the technology changed. You go from you weren't filing in 89, you weren't filing anything for a website. And in 08, nope. You had to fill out a website. You probably had to start. Well, it was almost the beginning. You know, Twitter had started in 08. You probably had to do something for Facebook, and then you had to, oh, by the way, do the radio thing.
Right.
That was, but you were. It's not like you weren't completely involved on the PR side of things. You knew that those things existed and that they had to be done, and that reporters had to do it. Did you enjoy having to do all those things?
Yeah, I did. I did because it gave you another avenue to, you know, expose people to your work. You know, I mean, obviously the radio listener is the most important thing when you do a story, but then you also had the opportunity to show people your work through Twitter and Facebook and other avenues as well. So I really, you know, from an old marketer standpoint, I mean, that was gold right there to be able to expose your product to a lot more people. And you talked about technology changes, and I laughed because, like going to a meeting back in the 80s, you know, you'd do an interview, you'd go find a payphone, and you'd hold your recorder up to the phone, play the audio from the interview that you did, do kind of a wrap around it, and hang up, and you were done. You'd head to social hour. And now, you know, these days, I'm seriously would do 16-hour days at meetings, covering the meeting and then going back to the motel room and working to post things online and, edit interviews and make sure everything was done correctly that way. So things changed a lot in that, what would that be, 20-year period.
It was an evolution. It's not, again, you can't shake, just like right now, I'm sure you've probably already read a paper or looked at a website or two this morning. In the couple hours you've been awake, you can't shake it right away. And you didn't shake it from 89 to 08 on what was going on in the news. You had to, because that's what was, you were in that line of work. So let's go back to the coverage. You were right there in the 80s. And we always, that there were stories, and the question has come up, and it's always discussed in a newsroom that covers agriculture or rural area. Are we seeing another farm crisis? And you have to think of, that's not necessarily my job to frame that, but it's my job to keep an eye out for things or what signs. I mean, you look at reports and you see economic trends and you look to today and go, oh my goodness, is this run up of $2 in 3 weeks in soybeans? Is that, oh my goodness, is there a bubble? Is this a repeat of... Your history and your perspective has allowed you to be the sage in the room and say, now just wait a minute. Here's why. Did you take that role seriously as the guy with the grayer hair in the corner of the room that had to say, you know what, we ought to be looking at certain things?
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not a marketing expert at all. So I don't pretend to give marketing advice, but I do like to talk to the marketing experts, and nearly every one of them would tell you, this is not sustainable right now, and everything that goes up is going to come back down at some point and possibly crashing back down. I'm not predicting that, but the point being, take advantage of these prices while you can, and yeah, I saw a lot of cycles over the years of prices going up and people saying, okay, beans are at 850. I'm going to hold out for 875, and it never gets there. And they've still got beans in the bin from 2-3 years ago, So yeah, but you talked about the 80s, and that was tough. I mean, that was really tough time for agriculture. And while the last few years have been challenging, I don't think they compare at all to what we went through in the 80s. And part of that is the big, what I've referred to as the golden years of 2008 to 2013, really gave a lot of people, thankfully, a really firm foundation to live on through the last few years that have been pretty tough. And now, hopefully this is another golden age that can last for a while, and we can get some of these people going again, because, they've held back the last few years. They've tightened the belts and done a great job of doing that. And now it's time to maybe start, if they can, start buying some new equipment and kind of get the whole agricultural thing rolling again.
Well, they go in cycles. Usually when Wall Street is doing well, Main Street is struggling in a rural area, and the commodities, when they're booming. Right now, we're both booming. So yep. I don't know what that means. I don't know which one's going to blink first. But when you look at perspective on things and you talk to farmers, do you find them guarded and just kind of, they're more apt to look for when that other shoe is going to drop about a price or a trade story or a regulation? Or do you find that the farmer is a little more guarded and a little more, I won't say pessimistic, but they really examine what's going on? They're really paying attention to things?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think farmers... I mean, they're optimistic. They have to be a farmer. You go out and you put the seed in the ground, and you've got to be optimistic that you're going to have a great crop, and it's going to grow, and you're going to get the rain, and everything's going to turn. You got to be optimistic to be a farmer. But at the same time, I think they're also realistic about what can happen and the things that are out of their control, whether it be, some kind of government intervention in their business, and whether it be a political dispute between countries, say some kind of new problem develops with China that causes markets to tank again. Hopefully that doesn't happen. And so I know farmers are optimistic, but they're also realistic. I very rarely run into really negative farmers, because I don't think you can be negative and be a farmer for very long.
Those are the ones that call you complaining about your story, right?
Yeah.
When you look back at this career and you look at what's in front of you, what are you going to miss most about going to work every day?
Well, I already miss the interaction with my coworkers. Even though I worked remotely, I worked at home. Brownfield had a team of 10 of us that, we were communicating back and forth through email and visiting by phone on a daily basis. So that's something I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss seeing the farmers and the relationships that I've built there over the years, all across the country. Hopefully I'll still have a chance to see them once in a while and run into them, going to the state fairs or maybe some of the local ag meetings, just to stay in touch. So that's the biggest thing I'll miss. And yeah, it'll be different.
Well, you're going to have to, you have to pay, at least get into the Iowa State Fair. I don't know how Nebraska works or some of the other ones. But at least before you would get reimbursed for your effort. Now that dime is on yours. You really are going to have to, when we see you somewhere, Ken, we'll know you really want to be there.
Well, a lot of those places always provided, complimentary registration to the media. And gosh, now I'm going to have to pay for it. I don't know. But
yeah. Maybe you should write a blog or something like that, so you can still claim. It's like a professor, and you claim the there's the title that they have, emeritus status. We'll call you with emeritus status. How about that?
Exactly.
All right. So this is probably the question that you had in those last few weeks at Brownfield was, what story stood out to you? What were, I'm not going to say your favorite story, but what were two or three that you were just like, gosh, I can't believe I actually get to do this.
I covered a lot of being based in Lincoln, covering Nebraska and Iowa. The ethanol story was really big. From when I started in 2008 to 2020, the ethanol story was just really getting started in 2008. Now, I can go back to the 80s when there were guys who were promoting gasohol back then. And, those pioneers who had the vision to say, this is going to be big someday. Well, it took a while. But when that hit in 2008, then that's what created what I call the golden age of agriculture at that point. And so ethanol was such a big story. And I really tried to stay on top of that. Almost on a daily basis, reporting on something involving ethanol. And of course, cattle. And in this part of the country are so big. So we spent a lot of time covering the cattle side of agriculture as well. So important to the listeners in this part of the country. The biggest story of my career, and it's kind of a, it's not a, a real, not a real serious story, but it's, it turned out to be the biggest story as far as how widespread it was seen and heard. I was at a meeting in Kansas City of the Animal Agriculture Alliance, and there was a speaker there from Domino's Pizza, and his name is Tim McIntyre, and he was talking about how Domino's was not going to bow to the animal rights activists who were demanding that, all of the ingredients used in Domino's pizzas be raised in a humane fashion, which all animals are raised, farm animals, in my opinion, are raised humanely. But, you know, the Humane Society of the United States was making their big push and pressuring these companies to say, okay, we're going to go away from gestation stalls. We're going to go away from cages for chickens and such. Anyway, I interviewed Tim McIntyre at the conference, and he was fired up, and he made a statement saying, we will never, or what did he say? He said, we'll always listen to the farmer. They know what is right. At Domino's, we will do, we believe the farmers is right. And so I made a story out of that, and it just went viral. It went crazy. And it brought reaction from both sides, the people that were saying, yay, Domino's, thanks for standing up for us. And of course, then you had the animal rights folks on the other side who were just outraged by this comment from Domino's. And it became a huge story. In fact, the Animal Ag Alliance, I believe it was, then went on and created a Thank You Domino's Day and encouraged folks to go out and buy Domino's pizzas, order Domino's pizzas that particular day. So that ended up being the big story of my career. And I did spend a lot of time also talking about the animal rights movement at that time. Wayne Pacelli and Paul Shapiro of the Humane Society of the United States, they were dead set on trying to eliminate animal agriculture, or at least change it to the point that it was really difficult for farmers to do what they wanted to do. And so I did a lot of reporting on that. And, I'd like to think maybe that I helped create the awareness that has kind of led to that movement kind of backing off. I'm not taking all the credit for it at all, but I worked hard to try to create awareness of the situation and what those folks were trying to do.
And we know that you'll keep an eye on it as you continue on being a now just a consumer and not just a reporter. All right, Ken, last hard question. Get ready. Who lasts longer in Lincoln as an employee of the University of Nebraska, Fred Hoiberg or Scott Frost?
They're both, I think they're both really good coaches, and I hope they get the people in here that they need to succeed. The recruiting is become more of a challenge than it was 20 years ago. And I can't quite put my finger on that, but they're not getting in my opinion, the level of athletes that we used to here. So I think they're good coaches, but I think they need to find better talent.
So it sounds like Hoiberg sounds like Hoiberg's lasting longer, if I'm reading between the lines, Ken.
Well, a lot of folks are frustrated with the football situation.
Yeah. All right. Well, the most controversial thing Ken Anderson says, no, it's going to be about sports. All right, Ken, congratulations on a great career. Thank you. I'm going to miss seeing you. I mean, I don't get out in the field that often as you did, but you were always kind when we would have interactions, at least allowing those crazy TV people to sometimes horn in on an interview with you or at least be in that circle. And that circle has changed. The reporters it just evolves over time. And that's just something that you won't be having to stand around talking with somebody with your hand out like this, getting a soundbite now.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was a great career. And especially as I said, the last 12 years with Brownfield, great organization. And I really feel good about what we accomplished there. And I, as I told them, I'm going to be watching what they do. So, and I'll be staying in touch.
All right. Ken Anderson, thank you so much. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Paul.
My thanks to Ken Anderson. Best to you in your retirement as the travel bug hopefully allows you to return soon to getting to see those items across the country. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for listening. We'll see you next time.